There are three kinds of people: those who make things happen, those who let things happen, and those who ask, what happened? This podcast is for those who refuse to settle, the CEOs who were built for more, the leaders who are ready to stop carrying the weight alone. You'll meet real leaders, real struggles, and real breakthroughs. This is the Make Big Happen podcast with Mark Moses. Welcome to the Make Big Happen podcast. I'm Mark Moses, founder and chairman of CEO Coaching International. My guest today is Jasper Weir, co-founder and president of TaskUs, a company that started with $20,000 and is now a publicly traded billion-dollar global enterprise. But this isn't just any interview. I had the opportunity to coach Jasper, his co-founder Bryce, and 11 members of their leadership team. I facilitated their quarterly planning sessions for 8 years. I've been in the room for the wins, the struggles, and everything in between. When I first met Jasper and Bryce in 2014, they were 28 years old, still living at their parents' house, running a $6 million business. And the early days were scrappy. They even made TV news in the Philippines because of cockroaches in their office. And Jasper will tell us a little bit about that in a moment. But don't let the scrappy start fool you. TaskUs has been named one of the best places to work year after year. And Jasper and Bryce were named Entrepreneur of the Year. They built something really special, and they did it with intention. I'll never forget one of our first conversations. I asked them, imagine, and they like to give me a hard time about this. Imagine it was the end of 2020 and they felt awesome. What is success? And without hesitation, they said, we built a billion-dollar company. Most people would have laughed, but they were serious. What happened next is one of the most remarkable entrepreneurial journeys I've ever seen. And here's what I love most. When I met them, they were two bachelors, good-looking bachelors, grinding it out. Today, they're both married with 5 children between them. They didn't just build a great company. They built some pretty cool lives as well. Today, we're going to have an honest conversation about what it really takes, the mistakes, the dark moments, and the triumphs. Jasper, welcome to the Make Big Happen podcast.
Mark, it's a pleasure to be here and super fun hearing that intro. And one point of clarification for the audience, Bryce and I do not have 5 children together. We have our own wives.
Thank you, Jasper. Appreciate that clarification.
Often misconception.
Yeah, understood. So, hey, for our listeners that don't know much about TaskUs or never heard of it, what's the 30-second version of what you guys actually do?
TaskUs offers outsourced customer support, content moderation, and other operational and essential business services for the world's largest technology companies. So if you ever take a rideshare or order food from a delivery app, have a problem, and contact customer support by calling or chatting, you're probably getting one of our people, as an example.
Yeah, cool. So before TaskUs, you guys tried a little venture in Argentina. Tell us about what happened down in Argentina and why Argentina?
So Bryce and I are best friends from high school, and we started our first business together when we were 19. This was actually before the Argentina venture. We used to throw parties in Hollywood, and that's how we made our initial startup capital that we were going to use to go move down to Buenos Aires, Argentina, and open frozen yogurt stores. That was our idea. We developed a business plan. We went down to meet with chemists to mix our flavors, had our locations picked out, and then ultimately decided going down to Argentina to try to build wealth in the volatile peso and earn in dollars wasn't necessarily, and live in dollars back in the US probably wasn't the best idea. As simple as that sounds, we didn't really know. We were 21 and 22 years old at the time. But through that process and that kind of failed attempt in Argentina, as simple as this sounds, we started thinking about the global economy. We said, hey, rather than earn money in pesos, how do we pay in pesos and earn in dollars? And that's pretty obvious, but not to 21 and 22 year olds. And through that, we started thinking about the global labor marketplace, and virtual assistants. And that's ultimately how TaskUs was launched back in 2008.
So you get back after this crazy ice cream venture, and why outsourcing and why the Philippines?
So Tim Ferriss, I'm sure your listeners know the 4-Hour Workweek, pivotal book in terms of making people really think about leveraging their time and leveraging the global talent pool. So Tim really romanticizes this idea of a virtual assistant in the book. And so we had read that and we said, wow, this is the future of how people are going to work. We need to get in this trend. But we didn't know anything about anything really, and started researching, well, where are the most popular countries where we could have virtual assistants? And it started in Argentina. We said, hey, can we do it in Argentina? Didn't work there. But then we started looking at a dozen different countries. And Bryce and I would literally look through a call center directory, and we would call other call centers, tell them this idea we had, and try to convince them to give us a week free with one of their people so we could kind of test this service. So we had tested all these different countries. We had them doing random tasks for us, figured out who was good at English, and in a very haphazard way, decided the Philippines was the best place for us to open our operations because the English was excellent. The attention to service was fantastic. Any of you that have dealt with Filipinos or have Filipino friends know just how amazing people they are. And for the cost, we found that to be the very best place in the world. Now, we were lucky. It was actually, this was 2008. 2009 is the year that the Philippines actually became larger than India for BPO, our industry, which is business process outsourcing, which encompasses the call center industry amongst others. And so we were kind of right place at the right time as we chose the Philippines.
How scrappy was it in the early days?
Oh my God. Mark, Bryce and I were in Santa Monica. We lived at home with our parents. We would work out of a spare room in Bryce's parents' house. We had like old school phones for our monitors and our computers. I found somebody on Craigslist. This was the global financial crisis, right? And so I'd go on Craigslist and I'd find businesses shutting down and I'd go barter and get all this office equipment. And I'd show them, I literally print out pictures of our website and say, here, I'm going to give you hours of service on this website that we're building, but I need all of these office chairs, all these computers. And we were able to strike deals because of the time. But that's how scrappy it was in Santa Monica. Eventually, we opened a small office in the Philippines. Our office in the Philippines, most call centers are located kind of in downtown Manila, the metro area. There's hotels, there's restaurants. It's very urban. But we couldn't afford to be there. So we opened an office, which is about an hour outside of Manila in a town called Bacoor, Cavite. And we opened one little office on the second floor of an auto mechanic shop. That's all we could afford at the time. We had plastic chairs for office chairs. We had small and very cheap computer monitors, residential internet lines, cockroaches and rats who would sometimes chew on the wires and internet would go down. I mean, it was crazy, but we didn't have any money, you know, and we also didn't know any better. So that's how scrappy it was. And it didn't get better for a long time.
So I remember one day I was talking to Bryce and he was devastated about the news with the cockroaches in the office. Tell us about that.
It was much more than cockroaches. So we went under investigation by the NBI, which is like the Filipino version of the FBI. And they had alleged that we had pirated software and really had come in to just kind of see what we were doing and see if they could find a way to make money from us, which we did not comply with. But they shut our operations down, brought in TV cameras to try to embarrass us. And it was just one of those experiences that I remember Bryce and I being on the phone, we weren't in the same city at the time, just saying like, well, it's been a good run, but clearly this is the end. So it turned out to be a really pivotal moment for us because to see our team react the way that they did and do literally heroic things to get our clients back online showed the resiliency of our team and the business. And from that moment on, and brought us closer together as a team, really. And from that moment on, I think we knew we could overcome even the largest of challenges.
I've been down there with you and went to Chateau Ridiculous. It is absolutely ridiculous. I couldn't believe when we walked in and how nice it was. It was, it's like everything I imagined, the coolest Google office ever. It was incredible. How did you go from this cockroach office to the Chateau Ridiculous and all the other offices that are just so unique and cool?
We always wanted nice offices. We just couldn't afford it at first. And so as soon as the business started to get some traction and we started to make some money and we were growing, outgrowing our space, we said, look, we really believe that we can create a differentiator in our service. And our service is arguably a commodity. There's tons of companies that deliver outsourced customer support, content moderation, other services. You can find hundreds of companies that'll do that. So we looked around at our competitors and we saw that the call centers that existed is what you'd expect of a call center. 50 shades of beige, cubicle farm, people are just numbers. And we always, like, we never thought that was the right way to treat people. You know, our early experiences, we'd go to the Philippines and these employees of ours were, they were our age and we could connect to them and we could see that they were just like us. They wanted growth experiences. They wanted to get better at their jobs. They wanted to work hard and provide for their families and make a living and move out of their parents' houses. And so we set up our culture and our company in a way that prioritized the frontline teammate. And the frontline teammate for us is the, it is our product. Same way that Amazon is customer focused maniacally and Apple is product focused maniacally, for us, we are focused on the employee experience as the product. And so part of that product, getting back to the offices, is we said, look, the other thing we have here is our clients are all these like high flying Silicon Valley, you know, startups that are becoming huge enterprises. These are all name brand companies. You know, you pick up your phone, look at your app list on your homepage. We support most of those businesses. These businesses care about people. They are famous for, like what you said, Mark, the Google type offices and amenities and benefits. And we said, look, if we can create these vibrant workspaces that people want to be at, it's going to have a lot of positive impact on the business. A, we're going to be able to recruit better talent. And by the way, when they're in our offices, everything is so cool. They're taking photos and they're posting it to Instagram or TikTok, which is a self-fulfilling prophecy in terms of recruitment. And we can recruit at a much lower cost. That's one. We can retain people because we're building spaces people actually want to be in. They feel valued when they're in these spaces. They can be more productive when they're in these offices. And then lastly, when our clients come to visit or our prospective clients come to visit, they show up at the office. And for a lot of our clients early days, not as much today, but early days, we were often the first time that they were outsourcing. And it's a scary thing for a company that, for any company, but really especially companies that feel like they have this amazing culture they don't want to lose. And part of that comes from their offices. And so they come to our office and they say, wow, this is incredible. And what they say time and time again is, this feels like one of our offices. That is by design. And for us, the more we can make them feel like, hey, this is not such a scary thing going to some random call center halfway around the world. This feels like us and this feels like our culture. That really allowed us to have a lot of early success because not everyone looked like us. And frankly, we weren't trying to market to every single customer. We avoided the large telcos, the big insurance companies, the traditional banks. We avoided them for many years, largely because it was hard for us to break in. We didn't know anyone at any of these companies, but also we didn't think that they would truly value the way we treated our employees. They wouldn't truly value, and we don't think some of them truly value customer experiences. And so we found much better alignment with these kind of high growth consumer web companies.
So I remember in the early days when you guys were explaining the business to me, and Uber was your biggest customer at the time. And you also said you worked with, and I understand some of the complaints that people might call in for with Uber, the late fee or the cancel charge or whatever it is, didn't like my driver, whatever. But you also worked with Tinder. What kind of complaints were you getting there?
I can't speak directly to the work of our clients, but there's all sorts of things associated with any application if you're locked out, if you have billing issues, any ways of using the application. So there's a level of support needed really for any physical product. And they're the same thing for any digital product. And look, it could be like such a tiny, tiny scale because people could think, well, why would anyone ever call that? person, right? Same thing. Like, think about like a McDonald's. McDonald's has a customer support team. Where would anyone want to call McDonald's? You know, but one in out of every 100,000, 10,000 visits or customer interactions, something goes wrong or some customer does need to get in touch. And so for even the products that you can't even imagine what they would have a need for customer support for, there might be a smaller need. We also do other services, things like content moderation, which any social network or dating app would need, things like data annotation and other things that are used to kind of train AI algorithms. And so it's sometimes not customer facing work and things that are going on behind the scenes that are helping to build or refine some of the technology products that our clients built.
So in 2014, when you and Bryce sought out coaching, why did you seek out coaching? Firstly, you're younger than most of our clients at 28. And by the time folks get to 6 million, they often think they have it all figured out. So what was it for you guys?
You know, and Mark, you weren't even our first coach. I believe you were our third potentially. And so from the very get-go, Bryce and I kind of, we started this business the week after we graduated college. At least I did. Bryce is a bit of an overachiever. So he finished school in 3 years and was investment banking for a year before we did this. But we essentially had zero experience. And we just knew, and we were just getting our ass kicked. And we knew that, like anything, if you want to be great, talk to people who are great and get coaching. It's, you know, both Bryce and I share a love for fitness with you, and we're in pretty good shape. But still, we still work with coaches and people still work with trainers. That's why professional athletes work with trainers, because if you want to be the best at something, go get the best coach in the world. That's what I think. And so we knew, and from an early stage, we said, look, we are so young, we are so inexperienced. If we do not treat this like our business school, the business school that we never went to, we're going to fail. We knew that. And one of our core values in the company was continuous self-improvement, and we needed to model that for everyone else. And so from the get-go, we believed in, let's absorb any piece of content we can about business and about business management, about leadership, and let's go get coaches. Let's go find a framework. Let's go run this like a real business. And so so when we started our journey, we had different coaches. And then I think Bryce was introduced to you through the YPO network of sorts. And then you and I started talking. And so, yeah, we just knew that you had been there before. You had seen companies like this. And look, we really believe in learning from mistakes, but even better is learning from other people's mistakes. And so if we could shortcut our journey in any way, we're game. And to this day, continue to be big believers in continuous self-improvement in business and in all areas of our lives.
It's interesting. Even you and I are both playing paddle now, and we're both using the same coach to improve our game. So well said. So, hey, shoot me straight. When you guys set out that billion-dollar vision, and right at the beginning, did you really believe it, or was it a made-up number?
So I'll tell you, it was 2012, and or was it 2010? I think it was 2010, actually. I think it was 2010, and we had a coach, this was before you, and who said, you have to set a BHAG, a big, hairy, audacious goal, a 10-year goal that's so crazy people are not going to believe you. So we said, okay, well, if we just double revenue every year, I think we're maybe at 2 million. We said, all right, well, if we just double revenue every year, we'll be at $1 billion in 10 years. And so that became our big, hairy, audacious goal. And people thought we were absolutely crazy. And 10 years later, to the house, 10 years later, we didn't get to a billion, but we got halfway there in terms of revenue. And so we're over a billion now, but it gets harder to double as you get bigger, funny enough. But we had many years of triple digit growth. Some years, we had 1 year, we went from 13 million to 54 million in a year, right? So we had some tremendous growth years. And we always look back at that big, hairy, audacious goal. You know, when we set it, we thought we could do it. And I remember the coach telling us at the time, the way he described it, it's like, you know, you throw your hat over the wall, you don't know how you're going to get it, but you know, you got to go get that hat. That's kind of how we figured how we thought about this goal. And we put it on a paper in the office, and people would come in and people would think that we're crazy, but we knew we could build something big. I don't know deep down that we thought we'd actually hit that goal, but we knew the importance of thinking big. And that's why we continually went back to that goal and rallied the team around being like, guys, we're building a big company here.
Yeah, if my recollection's correct, it was like something like 6, 15, 52, 80, 120, 250, 400 and something, yes. 700 and something. It was amazing growth in it. As the numbers got bigger, that kind of growth got hard.
Yeah. You know, leading up to our IPO in 2021, our trailing four-year revenue CAGR, our compounded annual growth rate for the previous 4 years was 62%, I believe, and higher in EBITDA. So that's the average compounding growth. So yeah, it was a tremendous stretch of time there for us. Right place, right time, hard work and good execution, right clients as well, and certainly some luck, but it was a tremendous growth stretch for us leading up to the IPO.
I got to go out of order because I remember one day we were in the Philippines together and Bryce and I were on the treadmill. And of course, he's a super great athlete and he's going super fast. And I didn't have to keep up with him on the treadmill. We could just speak to each other. And you were like lounging around the gym, schmoozing with, I said, man, what kind of workouts is this guy doing that? I gave you a hard time after. And do you remember what you said? You were out trying to get a deal done with one of the San Francisco really cool companies. And you said, man, I think I just got a deal done. And you're just working your way around the gym. And you said, that's everybody goes. Everybody stays at the same hotel. And the gym in the morning is the best place to meet everybody.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. I mean,
not your best workout, but you got a bunch of work done.
I work out after that. Don't worry.
So you started implementing the quarterly sessions with the leadership team. What changed about the way you operated when you began to do that?
You know, Mark, I look back and when I talk to other earlier stage companies, I look back at what we did with your help in establishing really an operating cadence and like a leadership management cadence that was probably fully overprocessed when we started for how small of a company we were. It was probably overkill, but it was the best thing we ever did as a company because like anything else, it's a muscle. And to this day, we still have more or less the same structure for our strategic plannings. And that consistency is so important and the focus on goal setting is so important. And when you're early on, I remember it's you set these goals a quarter out and you can't even think the next day. And yet you're setting these quarterly goals and you say, how this is crazy. This stuff actually work. And at first, the first few quarters are hard and you miss, right? Like you overcorrect or you don't have a big enough goal. And over time though, you start seeing and getting better at actually the practice of setting goals and understanding what is achievable. And then once you start doing that and can create a cadence in which you're setting the right goals, which are pushing your team just enough, It's magic what happens when you start seeing, you know, you make that $1 million revenue goal and all of a sudden the revenue that comes in is $1,000,001. It's unbelievable what setting goals can do and what intention can do and how it can go down if you truly believe it throughout the whole business. And so we had this quarterly cadence of how we set goals, how we talk about the most important things in the business and how we come together as a leadership team. And while the composition of the leadership team changes, the business challenges change, the practice of getting together, especially in a remote environment, which we are now from an executive team perspective, getting together in person, we just did this 2 weeks ago in Austin, is to chart the course of the business is so important and something that I find most smaller companies miss entirely. And really, if they want to be successful and grow, I truly believe this sort of discipline and structure is super important.
Yeah, you mentioned people a moment ago, and one of the hardest things for a growing company is that people to get a business from A to B are typically not the same people for B to C, C to D, and so on. How difficult was that for you guys to make those changes with people that you liked but just weren't effective at that next level of growth along the way?
It's the hardest thing I think leaders are faced with are these decisions, especially when that person from A to B has been good and they've been good and they're good people and they have a family and you truly care, you love them. You spend so much time at work, you develop these super close relationships with your colleagues. That's a good thing. And then it comes to the point where they're not just quite delivering the way they used to. And it's not them. It's the stage of the company has outgrown them. And that's the hardest decision to make. That is the hardest decision to make because, you know, everything in your mind and your soul and your heart wants to see them succeed. But if they're not succeeding, you're holding everybody else back. And here's the thing. As employers, here's what we found. We tend to think as employers that we're the best employer that they could possibly ever work for. And how could they live without us? That's just wrong. And if they're not thriving and if they're not succeeding in their role at that time, they're going to thrive somewhere else. And so if you really do care about them, actually letting them go is the right thing for them as well. And you can do it compassionately. You can do it with lots of notice. You can always make sure that you're coaching them up to the best of your ability to make sure it's not on you, but it's not on them. And when that happens, you have to make the hard decision and move on. And what happens is everyone else around you will be thankful that you made that decision and likely will say, "What took so long? What took so long? This was obvious to us."
Yeah, or we thought everybody knew but you. Yeah. Right. And here you're sitting there feeling bad about it, struggling over some of those decisions. So you guys have been named going from cockroaches in the early days to one of the best places to work year after year in an industry that's not known for treating people as well as you guys do or well at all. What did you do differently than everybody else? And when did you realize how important culture was as your competitive weapon?
We knew culture was going to be important very early on. And early, like first year or two, we knew that we wanted to build this great culture. We knew how important that was. But the truth is, we didn't know truly what great culture looked like. We thought great culture was having ping pong tables and a cool office and that sort of thing. And we over time realized that's really not what it's about whatsoever. That's not the substance of it. And it took us some real soul searching and help from one of our executives, Robert Hayes, who, you know, was our former COO at the time. Was a great operator. We together kind of came up with this kind of architect of this idea that said, hey, if we think we have this great culture, we should measure it, and then we should manage it. And so we started back in probably 2013 or so, we started measuring our culture. And we used the ENPS metric, the Employee Net Promoter Score, which asks, how likely are you to recommend TaskUs as a place to work to one of your family or friends? Just like those annoying consumer surveys you get. So we started surveying everyone in the company. And at this point, we had hundreds, if not, you know, a couple thousand people working for us. And we thought we had this great culture. We thought everyone loved working at TaskUs. And we got that survey result back. And the NPS goes from negative 100 to 100, right? We get our survey result back. And our ENPS was a 4, not a 40, a 0-4. And that was an important moment for us where we had two options. We said, look, either we ignore the data and we say, you know what? Like, no, they don't really know what they're talking about. People just want more money, whatever. Or you say, look, this is feedback. Feedback is a gift. Let's listen and let's adapt and let's do something different. And that's the approach that we decided to take. And so we developed this process that every quarter we started looking not just at the metric, but what were the verbatim comments that people were telling us in the surveys and really trying to nail down what are the things that people actually really care about? What correlation are we seeing in the data when we make certain investments? And each quarter, we look at it, we decide, like any goal and like managing any metric, we would decide on some specific and achievable outcome-based goals that we could implement for the quarter. We would go on a little roadshow and tell people in the office, here's what you said, here's the score, here are our goals to address this metric. And we'd measure it again the next quarter and we'd do that process over and over and over again. And so over time, our ENPS over the few years grew each quarter and we kind of leveled out in the 60s or 70s for ENPS, which is extremely, extremely high and have been able to stay there, depends on the geo, still have an extremely high ENPS and it still is an important metric in our business. And so for us, it was about putting our money where our mouth was and making that metric as important as revenue and profit, making that metric part of the bonus compensation plan for our executive team and for certain managers throughout the organization that had control over that. So that's kind of how we took this soft, nebulous thing of culture and tried to make it a little bit more I'd say, quantifiable and outcome-based in a way that we knew how to manage.
I saw you guys do it. I saw how serious you took that. And I saw the impact it had. It was incredible. Really something you, Bryce, and your entire leadership team ought to be really proud of. Speaking of Bryce, many entrepreneurs have partners, as you and Bryce have been best friends and partners for almost 20 years-ish. What's the hardest part of a co-founder relationship?
The hardest part is when you're not making money. Money, success, change, success makes things easier at times. Look, the hardest part is the same thing that you have in any close relationship. It's like, I mean, it's like Bryce is like my brother. It's the relationship we have is like being married, right? And so it comes down to communication. And I think, you know, look, when you're building, when you're having growth and new challenges constantly, and trying to figure out who's best at what, who should be doing what, it can be really challenging when you have two people that are both pretty hard-headed, hard-charging, and believe in themselves. There can be friction. And so I think at the end of the day, when there's too much ego involved, partnerships will really deteriorate. When you're able to put egos aside and do what is truly in the best interest of the company, partnerships can thrive. You know, Bryce and I have certainly had our differences over the years, but you know, I'd say in the last 10 years, it's so much different than the first 10 for us. I mean, hey, we're kind of older and more mature and have other things in our lives like families that are so important for us. It makes some of the little things in the business just kind of puts it into perspective. But we just know each other really well, and we've learned to, I think, like a good marriage, if there are things that annoy you about your partner, that could be really challenging. But if you find a way to make the things that annoy you about the partner, if you find a way to kind of adore them for that and to respect them and really like those things, that's when a partnership can thrive. And so Bryce and I have a lot of differences. And I think once we were able to truly respect each other's differences and just see them as like, hey, we are different people. And it's amazing that we have this partnership in which we have different strengths. Once both of us truly believe that, you know, we'll have disagreements here and there, but like our relationship has been super solid for a long time.
So what advice would you give partners that are in their business at whatever stage of the journey that they're on that are struggling? Sometimes it's over, one's got more passion for the business at a time than another. Sometimes they're pulled away for family commitments or maybe even sickness. What advice would you give to those that are struggling?
Go on walks together. That's an important one. Any sort of meetings. I find walking to actually be really special and a really good way to talk. There's something about actually walking side by side someone. You're not sitting across from them at a table, which can be more intense. And moments of silence are natural, and moments of processing are natural in a way they're just not in a conversation when you're sitting down. And so for like big conversations, it's sometimes just like really nice to get out there and like also be outside. And so depending on, you know, when we were in Santa Monica, we'd walk almost every day. We just go around the office and we just take a few laps and we talk about whatever was coming up. You know, there's been times we've tried to schedule kind of partner meetings, but it's at breakfast every Friday, something like that. I think the important thing here, it doesn't matter what you do or how you do it, it's comes down to constant communication and open and honest communication about how you're feeling about the business. And if things are at a point of disagreement, finding a good mediator and finding a good coach. And Mark, you served this for us a couple of times, which was highly impactful. But sometimes you need somebody, just in the way that we were talking about coaching earlier, just the way I believe in kind of couples coaching is a really strong thing to do and a smart thing to do in your relationship before you have issues, right? And so learning to communicate, learning each other's differences, and making sure there is time to work on the partnership would be my advice.
Well said. At 32 years old, you guys decide to go through a process to sell the business. Why did you want to sell the business? Why did you choose Blackstone specifically? What were you looking for in a partner? And what did you learn going through that process?
You know, Bryce and I always wanted to create financial freedom for ourselves. And with the success that TaskUs was on, we still had not really capitalized on the enterprise value of the business. We pumped all cash back into the business. We took distributions we needed for living, but we lived extremely modestly. And so one of the things for us was, hey, things have been going really well. Let's monetize. We've been doing this for 10 years. If this business is worth, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars today, let's go sell at least some of our shares to make sure that for ourselves and our future families that we're set. That was always something that was really important to us. And so at that time, we kind of got to that place and we said, let's just go see what's possible at this point. And the business was growing super fast and continued to grow really fast, even through the process that we ran. So we went out, we got bids from 16 different private equity companies. We talked to some strategics as well who were interested in buying the whole business. But we decided, A, we only want to sell half of the business, or half of our shares, rather, because we want to monetize, but we think there's so much growth ahead of us. We want to maintain a big chunk of what we're doing. And Blackstone, for us, while it wasn't the highest bid, we were just really big fans of the team that we were going to be working with the firm overall. And, you know, there's a reason why they have the reputation they do. It's truly an incredible business. They've been great partners for us. So why did we want to partner? A, the monetization, being able to sell. And also, I think having the backing of a brand like Blackstone, while they've been helpful for introducing us to customers, and there's certainly things they've done to help our business. Nothing potentially tops just the brand recognition. And so when we go to our big clients, they know that, A, we're here to stay, that we're well-backed financially. And as we moved up the enterprise, people just took us a little bit more seriously. And I think hard to quantify exactly what that does, but it's certainly possible that that could have been enormous impact on our business. So we wanted to partner with people that would think about how to make money while we thought about how to run the business.
So then, a couple years later, you decide to go public. So why go public? Take us through. I was there with you and I was watching you guys in the pre when they were setting the price, and it was just, hey, what's going on over there? And I thought it was fascinating to watch. And then the bell rings and you open at $2.3 billion. And then it closes opening day at $3 billion. And take us through what that felt like.
Yeah. So we did our deal with Blackstone in 2018. The company continued to grow really well the first few years of the partnership. And so in 2020, we started talking to Blackstone, who said, hey, the markets are really hot right now. There's a very good IPO window, and this doesn't happen all the time. So let's get ready to go public. We said, all right, let's do it. If you guys say that's the right move, we're in. And so we began to prepare to go public. It was, I'd say, an incredible amount of work, an amazing learning experience through building a book, through pricing, through learning how kind of public markets work. For me, was really fascinating. We debuted, we wanted to set a reasonable price at the time for the IPO where we thought we could get some run up as well. I remember someone told us, no one's ever going to remember, except maybe for you, Mark, what your IPO price was, but they will remember, did you go up or down, and how did the IPO perform? So, you know, through the advice of our bankers and Blackstone, that was the price we set. And we had this tremendous journey up. We were a top 1% performer on NASDAQ for the first year of being public. So truly an incredible journey, and got up to, you know, over $8 billion in enterprise value for the business. And then things went down, but those are the public markets, and the ride up is certainly a lot more fun than the ride down.
For sure. So knowing what you know today, would you go public again?
Yeah, you know, it's a good question. I'd say, given the information we had at the time, yes. Because the market dislocation of public valuations to private valuations was so big that we had to do it. It made a lot of sense. So for us, it was definitely the right thing to do at the time. So, you know, unless you have the ability to predict the markets, I would say it was the right thing when we were doing it.
Recently, you guys tried to take the company private and it didn't happen. Are you able to speak to any of that?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, our independent shareholders, we put Blackstone, Bryce and myself, tried to take the company private. The independent shareholders voted down the bid we had made. which was a premium offer to where the stock was trading, and a bid that was approved by the special committee of the board. So we went through all the process, and some of the biggest independent shareholders thought the business should be valued higher. They came out publicly kind of stating some of these things, and ultimately they were not willing to take the price on the offer that we made on the business.
Now, let's go back to you being 28. You're the 28-year-old Jasper, knowing what you know now. What would you tell that guy?
Oh, man. I'd say find your authentic leadership voice and lean into being more you. You don't need to try to be more like Bryce. You don't need to try to be more like Mark. You don't need to try to be more like the CEOs you see on TV or in movies. Just be more you and lean into your own strengths. And lean into your strengths rather than spending so much time trying to shore up your weaknesses. Find a team that can shore up your weaknesses and go find your magic superpower and just go do that over and over again, because you can mess up a lot of things in business, but if you do one or two things right, you can be very successful. And so I'd encourage myself to think about my role, my leadership style, and my success in a way that allowed me to be more myself at the time.
You and Bryce built an incredible business, over $1 billion in revenue. Now you're married with kids. And how did you manage to do both? Build a great company, and also, I can't even picture you guys with five kids between you. And yes, with you both married to different wives. How'd you manage to do both?
You know, Mark, we were really lucky to have started the business so young. You know, the way we worked, and especially the way we traveled for the first 12 years of the business, we frankly just couldn't really do today with young children if you wanted to maintain a family. And so we were really lucky to be able to devote all of our 20s and some of our 30s just to the business. You know, and we had our social lives and we had fun and we did other things, but business came first and that was it. Like, we didn't have to think about family. And so I think we were fortunate to be able to do that. And then Bryce and I both knew we wanted, you know, families, we wanted children. And so we both kind of went out in the world and found amazing partners and started having kids at a very similar time, you know, maybe a little bit later than some. But for us, I think the business at that point was at a place where we said, look, we have great executive teams. We're still going to be working really hard, but we need to just work differently and smarter to be able to manage both family life and business life. And it's really, it's a challenge. And I can imagine how hard it would be starting a business in those first years with young children. That's got to be incredibly challenging. I don't know how you can do both well.
Yeah, understood. And a lot don't. They struggle with that. So before I ask you the last question, I don't want to miss asking you about AI. Peter Diamandis said there'll be two kinds of companies by the end of the decade, those that have fully embraced AI and those that have gone out of business. How has TaskUs embraced AI and used AI as a competitive advantage?
Look, for us, TaskUs is about providing solutions for our clients. And so while historically that's been largely people, technology has always played a role in what we're doing. The systems that we're using, the way we use technology to automate certain processes, we've been trying to automate things and be able to take technological leaps for our clients for many, many years. It's part of our business. AI represents a kind of step change function that's even higher and that can accelerate that sort of growth. And so TaskUs today has partnered with some technology companies like Decagon and Regal on the customer support side to go to market with technology partners and look at a customer support process as an example and say, hey, if something can be done with an agentic bot, like, we should do it with it, which is AI. We should do it with AI. But at the end of the day, you need to train the AI. You need to keep continuing to make sure it's optimized and constantly learning. And there are times where you're going to need people. And so we think that long-term TaskUs needs to provide both the technology, whether it's our own or our partners, along with people, because there's always going to be a need for people. Not everything's going to get automated. And so that's how we see the future of our business and integrating AI. It's going to be in everything that we do.
And for the entrepreneur listening who feels too small to dream big, what would you tell them?
One of my favorite quotes is, if you do not ask, you will not receive. So you just got to ask for what you want, and you have to know what you want. And we always said, like, why not? A lot of people have this kind of mentality of like, why wouldn't something work? And for us, it's like, well, why wouldn't we be the ones to build a big company? Why can't we be the ones who are going to be successful? Like, why not us? And I think, you know, Bryce and I have been incredibly lucky, but we're not technical. We're not the smartest guys in the world, but we work hard and we believe in ourselves. And if two kids who literally knew nothing right out of college in the middle of a recession can build a business with $20,000, there is no, I'd say, no limits to your vision and to your what success can become. The days are long, but the years are short. Over time, it's amazing what we can accomplish if we set big goals and hold ourselves accountable.
Well, Jasper, I want to thank you I appreciate having you as a friend. You're young, you're inspiring, you're fun to play paddle or cycle with or whatever it is, that adventure we're doing, whether it's seeing you in Saint-Tropez in the summer or wherever. I appreciate you employing my daughter, who loves it. It's been 5 years she's been at TaskUs and loves it and totally supports the commitment to culture and people and sees it every single day. And being that this is the first time I have taken over the Make Big Happen podcast, it's an honor and a privilege to have you, Jasper, as my first guest. So thank you.
The feelings are mutual, Mark. Thank you very much.
There are three kinds of people: those who make big happen, those who let things happen, and those who ask what happened. Don't just listen to these stories. Decide who you're going to be. Show notes and resources are available at CEOcoachinginternational.com. Subscribe so you don't miss what's next. At some point, every leader faces a choice. Play it safe or go big. If you're ready to make big happen, visit CEOcoachinginternational.com and learn how our been there, done that CEO coaches can help you make big happen.